Everyone worships. Everyone worships. And that really is our first point. We were made in the beginning to worship. Everyone in this room, whether you're a Christian or not, whether you attend church normally or you don't, everyone was not merely made to worship, but does worship. When God created us, He created us with the capacity for and an obligation to worship Him as the one who gifted us all things. There was to be this reciprocal relationship as we opened our eyes to a world around us brimming with all of God's goodness. We were to give to Him thanks and praise and honor and glory, to worship the one who had given all of these good things. He designated a time and a place even where we could meet with Him, as we spoke of a couple weeks ago, in order to facilitate that very reality. Us giving to God thanks and praise for all the good gifts that He's given to us. We were made to worship. It's what we are to be about in this life. It is what we will be about in some sense in the next life. And as we look at it, we live in a world full of worshipers. And that's what Paul says here in Romans chapter 1. We live in a world full of worshipers. Look at verse 19. Paul says three things very clearly in this text. In verse 19, one, everyone knows that God exists. That God has, through creation, manifest His power. He's placed eternity in our hearts. We're made in His image. There's nowhere you can go to blind yourself from the God who is. He has made Himself known in the world. So everyone knows God exists, according to verse 19, because God has made it plain to them. But also, we learn that not everyone worships or gives thanks to the God who is known. God makes Himself known, and what is expected then is a return of thanksgiving and worship. But according to Paul, not everybody does that. But notice the third thing we see in this text is that everyone worships something. Notice it's not that we decided not to worship God, therefore we turned the worship switch off. And we no longer are worshipers. I don't believe in you, and therefore I'm going to go do this completely human thing, devoid of God and devoid of worship. Notice what Paul says in verse 25. The reason God's judging them, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and they worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. So notice, everybody worships, according to Paul. It's a question of, what is it or who is it that you worship? Everyone holds something dear to themselves, prizes it above all else, desires it above everything else, shapes their life around it, and therefore has their life shaped by it. Everyone has a deep love which drives them. Everyone worships. I mentioned him before, but David Foster Wallace, who was pretty much a postmodern author, and yet was one who got very weary and wary of postmodernism, even while claiming that he was a proponent of it, gave a very famous speech that probably many of you have either read or heard at some point at Keynesian University called This Is Water. And in that speech, a man who was at that point, at least not publicly in any way, shape or form, a professed Christian, he was very much known again for being a postmodern thinker. He says these words: in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. An outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, whether it be Jesus Christ or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan mother goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are really where you tap the meaning of life, you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect. Being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. End quote. When people say all of life is worship, in this sense, they are very right. All of life, all of everybody's life, is worship. And when other people say things like, you know, Virginia is for lovers, they're right. But not just Virginia. Everywhere is for lovers. Everyone has a deepest love, a deepest desire, something they hold on to and honor above all things. We are made creatures who worship and are full of love in this way. As Christ says, wherever your treasure is, there your heart is also. There your loves are. There your worship is. Whatever we prize, notice, takes our heart. It takes our loves and our energies in that direction. So we have a world of worshipers, but we have a world of worshipers with misguided loves. And that's what Paul is telling us in this text. That there's this God who made us. Everyone knows it. He made us with the capacity to worship, and that part's a reality. But instead of worshiping Him, they chose to neglect Him, and therefore they end up worshiping other things. They have misguided or misdirected loves. Notice, prior to the fall in Genesis 1 and 2, our worship, our loves, our desires were all aimed at God. We worshiped the Creator just like we were intended to. Our loves for that very brief time were in the right order. Notice, Paul doesn't say that we're to love God and then hate all of creation. It's the question of how do you order your loves? What is the most important love, and what then gives meaning to everything else you love in the world? And there was that brief time in history where mankind's love was in the right order. First, second, and third were all correctly put in line. We didn't just love God, but our wife and the world in the proper way. And the fall happened, and of course, that order completely changed. And it does not take long in the story to see that unfold in an ugly way. You see, Adam and Eve, in the text we read this morning, they lowered their gaze. And they fell in love. That's what happens. And they literally fell, you know, falling into sin. But they fell in love for something else. Their desires were bent somewhere else. And that's what drove them to rebel and to fall, rebel against God and to fall. Notice they heard, through this temptation, a competing story. They've been told God's story. This is His narrative of the world. This was how things were to be ordered. And He said, I give it all to you, and here's how I want you to live in it. And if you live this way, the good life will come to fruition. And then they heard this competing story from another voice who told a different tale. And in his tale, he said, you know, don't listen to that first story. And for whatever reason, Eve and Adam found that story more lovely, more appealing, more compelling. And they desired something for the first time that was off limits and out of order. Did you hear the language in the text when she saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eye? And the tree was desired to make one wise. She took and ate. Notice that she had this deeper desire, a deeper desire than obeying the God who had made her, because of this appeal that had come from a competing narrative. Notice all that was in play. It wasn't just her intellect. It wasn't just her thinking the wrong thoughts, but having the wrong love. She wanted the wrong things. Something all of a sudden became more lovely, more appealing than the God of heaven. That is what James tells us is the root of all of our sin. Each person is tempted, how? When he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Notice he doesn't say, you know, his own illogical thinking. That there's something deep in the man that loves something more, and he's driven by those loves to certain actions and thoughts and rebellions. Since this day, Paul tells us in Romans 1, man's desire, his love, his worship is aimed at some part of the creation first instead of the Creator. And Paul says, you know, you could pick your poison. It's, you know, mortal man or beast or other things. But he says it's always something in creation. It's always something one step lower than the God who made it as your first priority. That is what disordered desires are. We have never stopped worshiping or desiring. We just now worship all the wrong stuff. As Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. That's right. Our hearts are full of worship. They're restless. They're wanting something to latch on to and love. They just do it constantly in the wrong direction. Or, as the country song goes, we're looking for love in all the wrong places. And that is the story of humanity. That is our problem. We are lovers by nature, but now we seek love in all the wrong directions. And because of that, there are horrible consequences. So first, everyone worships. The second thing is that worship shapes everyone. It's not just that everyone worships, but everyone is shaped by what they worship. Everyone is shaped by what they worship. Or you can say it this way, we are what we worship. You see, we began as people made in the image of God, placed in a situation where we could meet with God to learn, to love and desire Him more and more, and in so doing, reflect His glory more and more. In shorthand, to become more and more like God. We were placed in a situation that if we reflected rightly, if we worshiped rightly our Maker, we would only image Him more and more. We'd begin to look more like our Heavenly Father until coming to full maturity. To be conformed into His glorious image has always been the goal of our humanity. See, this is a clear principle of worship that can never be forgotten. Is this, we become like whatever we set our hearts on. We begin to reflect the things that we love. You know, that's why people begin to look like their dogs and other such strange things. That is what Paul tells us here in Romans 1. Look at verse 22. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creepy things. Therefore, God gave them up in their lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. They decided against worshiping the all-wise God and began to worship creation. And therefore, God said, fine, you want to worship animals? Then you can begin to live and act like animals. They decided against honoring God with their gifts. And God said, okay, then dishonor yourselves with what you have. When you admire something and give your time and energies to the object of adoration, you will begin to always take on characteristics of that object. I mean, you can know this biblical principle by mere observation, by empirical data. Go to any high school campus that doesn't wear uniforms, and I bet you, you can pinpoint what groups are what. How? By what they're wearing. Oh, I know what kind of music you're into by how low your pants are. I know what sort of sports you participate in because of the logos that are all over your clothing. We begin to emulate and to look like those things that we admire most because it's our deepest desire. And when we have this deep desire, it begins to show itself in our own persons. Even how one walks and talks can be clearly tied at times to what they hold valuable and dear and desirous. And this isn't just me talking. This is a clear principle of the Old Testament. Israel was often drawn to worship idols. She saw the other nations doing it, and she wanted to do it. And so she began. But God warned her in Psalm 135, the idols of the nations are silver and gold. They're the works of human hands, Romans chapter 1. These are creaturely things. They have mouths, but they do not speak. They have eyes, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear, nor is there any breath in their mouths. Here's the key. Those who make them become like them. So does anyone who trusts in them. Well, what's strange is that we hear these words out of the Lord's mouth in Isaiah chapter 42. You've turned your back and utterly been put to shame because you have trusted in carved idols. You've said to metal images, you are our gods. You worship these things. And here's what God says to them. Hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, so you may see. Who is blind but my servant, or deaf like the messenger I send? Who is blind as my dedicated one, or blind as the servant of the Lord? He sees many things, but he can't observe them. His ears are open, but he just doesn't hear. Does that sound familiar? These idols have eyes, but they don't see. Ears, but they don't hear. Minds, but they don't understand. And he goes, look at Israel over there. She has eyes, but just can't see anything. And ears, but she can't hear anything. She has a mouth, but can't see. She can't. Why? She has begun to look like those things that she has set her heart on. You want to worship idols? Then you will become like that which you worship. As the psalmist said, those who make idols will become like them. The reverse, though, is also true. Even as our text points out, if you worship the true and living God, you'll begin more and more to become like him. As we behold God in worship as he really is, as we point out his attributes, remember his mighty deeds, as we glory in the good news of his gospel, finding Jesus loving and compelling, we will be transformed, according to Scripture, into his likeness. You see, the goal of worship is the goal of salvation. To reflect God's glory, to become sanctified, right? To grow into the image of God. That's the goal of worship. Not just in this hour. The goal of all that we do in worship is to become more and more like God. Though we've been speaking of worship in the broadest sense, the all of life is worship, even when we reflect on the narrower sense that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago on the day of Pentecost, when we come to worship, it is to begin to set our eyes on the one who is lovely in order that we might begin to reflect that loveliness. Worship corporately is our drawing near to God in order to be shaped by God into God's image. We draw together in this hour to meet as a community, to be shaped by God into his image collectively. And then he sends us from this place to, Lord willing, reflect that and continue in that as we disperse. That is why worship is so important, is that no matter what, it shapes us. It conforms us into an image. If everyone is a worshiper and worship shapes everyone, notice that. The real question is, how do we go about worshiping in such a way that we get shaped in the right way? You're all going to worship. That's going to happen. So how do we begin to say, what is it that could be done where we would make sure that our desires get pointed in the right direction? Because all of us have these deep desires, some of them not even known to us on the surface, that keep skewing our ability to take hold of and love the God of Scripture. So what could we do? How could we shape worship in such a way that we make sure that we're aiming and pointing those desires in such a way that we begin to see God as altogether lovely and our hearts begin to be bent toward him as opposed to other things? That's the question we want to answer this morning in our last point. Worship must be shaped in order to shape. If worship shapes everyone, then you've got to ask the question, how should we shape our worship? Which is a question, oddly, that rarely gets asked. And that's something that just as an aside we should consider. This is one of the most important things that any church does. And the question of how many times do we ask ourselves, why is it we do what we do the way that we do it? Why sing this song instead of that song? Why have this order instead of that order? Or does it not matter at all how it's shaped? You see, the question underneath all of that really has to do with who we are as people. The reason we need to shape our worship is because we need to be shaped in a certain way. We need it to do some heavy lifting, which means if we decide what is best to us just off the top of our head, it will likely reflect all of the bad shapes that are already in us as it comes out in public worship, as we'll see here in a second. If we worship what we desire and worship shapes us, how do we go about undoing this vicious cycle where the wrong desires lead us to worship the wrong things that then shape us in the wrong way? I think we may be tempted to say wrongly, well, just, you know, learn that that's wrong, tell the truth, stop doing it that way, and move on. It's easy to say, you know, worshiping your wealth or your body or your lust or your ease is wrong and it's killing you. It's another thing on Monday to not be tempted by ease and wealth and lust and a whole host of other things, even though you know in your mind, these things are killing me. Why is it so hard for us humanly to know what things we need to avoid and yet still have some weird fatal attraction to those things that we know are doing such devastation to our own lives? I mean, you can see articles online all day long with the basic gist in the title, I've been dieting my whole life and I'm now fatter than ever. What is that saying? It's saying a very simple fact. I know what the problem is. I even have the ingredients for and the step-by-step instructions on how to solve the problem. But there's something else inside me that keeps wanting to eat the wrong things at the wrong time or maybe in too much quantity. There's something deeper going on than just having the right mental information and the right steps to follow. There's another impulse in me that even though I know the end result will still be this, I keep doing this other thing. And you can fill in the blank with whatever, you know, sins or struggles people have. You see, it's not first and foremost thoughts directing actions. Not that thought isn't part of it, don't get me wrong. But the fact is, most of our actions aren't even thought about. They're unconscious. I mean, think about how much you do in any given day that you just never even think about. You know, don't tell my wife, but there have been times I've driven 20 minutes and realized I haven't looked at the road once. And thinking, now how did I get here? How did I get here from where I... Well, because you've done something so many, you don't think about it anymore, but when you first started, you thought about it. You know, where's the brake and how does the steering wheel work and the blinker and is that the windshield wiper? But now those are just unconscious actions. Most of our actions aren't first and foremost thought about. They're subconscious. And even when our minds change about something, when we decide this action is bad, I don't want to do it anymore, oftentimes our actions don't change. Not right away anyway. I remember when I was first reading G.K. Chesterton, I got real kind of enthralled with his idea of localism and kind of supporting all local businesses and just, you know, living where you're at. And I thought, you know, this is great. And there was a book recommended on that subject that someone who studied Chesterton had written. And so I got on Amazon and I ordered the book. Which, of course, goes against every impulse that was just written about. Well, why would I, you know, continue to do all my Christmas shopping, for instance, on Amazon? Well, deep in my heart, I say, or my mind anyway, we should shop local. Well, because it's not first and foremost merely a mental thing. There's a whole host of other things going on that lead to what the output of an action is. There's something deeper, something under the surface, a desire, a vision of the good life, that betrays even at times my, you know, my thought life. You don't always love what you think you love. That's what one author says. You know, if you want to read more on this particular subject, and a lot of these thoughts are from there, Jamie Smith has a book, You Are What You Love. And it really gets to this particular issue. There are these loves that are functioning without necessarily telling you, without giving you a theology, for instance, of wealth and comfort. You may still have be the deepest theological proponent of wealth and comfort, right? Because you've been trained at times a particular way without even know you're being trained. Meaning, you live in a world and in a culture that's training you. Think of who we are as Californians. And why is it that when you mention you're from California somewhere else, there's this, oh, from California. And then all of these built-in assumptions of what that means. Well, because our culture shapes us a particular way. There's 1,000 stories being told and 1,000 desires being presented that shape us and form us and appeal to us without ever coming out and saying, we're trying to give you a theology of this and it's going to make you worship in this way. But whether we know it or not, it does affect us. In that same speech mentioned earlier by David Foster Wallace, He opens that speech by, you know, with an illustration that probably some of you have heard, where, you know, two younger fish are swimming in the ocean and they pass an older fish, and the older fish says to them, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two younger fish continue to swim for a bit, and eventually one looks over to the other and says, "What the heck is water?" Meaning that the environment that you're in can be so effusive that you don't even realize how much it's affecting or surrounding you. After telling us everybody worships in this speech, he also tells us this very profound truth. Look, the insidious things about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful. It's that they're unconscious. They are at times our default settings. These default settings that he refers to are what the Bible calls disordered desires, or what Calvin calls concupiscence, impulse or wrong loves. As we mentioned before, Cranmer, the man who writes that prayer of confession that we say often on Sunday mornings, he writes these words: "What the heart loves, the will chooses, and then the mind justifies." So notice what he says: all your reasons and defenses come after your loves. You decide what you love, and then you start building your fortress of reasons. It's not, "Well, here's the good reason, I was just logical. Every decision I've made, I've come to a logical conclusion about." No, you love something, and that love drove your decisions. You see, it's not only do desires shape us, but our desires are constantly being shaped. Because all of life is worship, because all of us are worshipers, all of us that imbibe in any kind of culture have a danger of our desires being shaped by what's being told around us, by the family you live in, the city you live in, the things that you watch and listen to. And I'm not saying that those things are wrong necessarily. It's the fact that they're just there and they're not thought about. But all of life is liturgical. All of life is shaping your habits. All of life is telling you a story about what the good life is, and you're either believing it or not believing it. If you don't believe culture shape you in that way, I will tell you one thing, especially young folks. In all of my childhood, all the way even into my 30s, I never saw one photo with someone making a duck face. Not one. My whole life. And some of you have never seen a photo without the duck face being made in it. Well, why is that? Because everyone just on their own logically came to the conclusion, this is the best way to take a picture. Or we all lived in a culture that so kept programming us or telling us a certain story that we decided, without ever deciding, this is what you do. There were desires being pulled at and shaped, and culture that was doing something to you that you had no interaction with on the mental or cerebral level. But it shaped you nonetheless. In his book, You Are What You Love, Jamie Smith talks about the religious nature of the mall, and how it deals in the very commerce of desires. He tells us, it doesn't tell us to believe anything. You don't walk in the mall and it presents you with big ideas about the philosophy of life and why you need this or that. It has its own rhythms and its own liturgy, and that liturgy is directly aimed at your heart, not at your brain. He says, as you walk through it in this temple-like setting, there's this big building that draws you in that will block out all natural light except that which comes from above. It will silence all the noise and busyness of your day. It will give you a peaceful and a serene setting in which to worship. It sets up icons. Sometimes they're patron saints of the mall, you know, the models displayed on the window showing you what life is really all about. Or they're just emblems and signs telling you if you had these things, then you would be living the good life. But notice, it's selling you a life without ever speaking a word. It is getting at the very core of your desires. And again, it's doing it at times without us ever knowing it. The very simple power of that illustration is this: all of life is liturgical. It has shapes and rituals that are seeking to shape our desires. Or as he says, the devil has all the best liturgies. You see, we are surrounded daily by desire shapers. From the mall to the gym to talk radio to TV to your online life as it's being portrayed. And all of those things shape your loves. And all of those loves being shaped will shape your actions. It will turn you into whatever you're worshiping. So how do we go after this? If all of this is around us, what can be done to put a chink in that armor, or to put at least put a little bit of a hole, the defense of that reality? Well, there has to be a competing vision of the good life. There has to be a way to present something else that then shapes you in different ways. And that is what ultimately we're doing here. You can't just change your loves by thinking your way out of it. New habits ultimately have to be formed. We need new loves. And the only way to do that is to find something else either more lovely, more desirous, more delightful than what you're currently loving. A counter desire. But counter desires are not instant. So if I'm here to tell you, and this is what I, you know, if you've checked out 10 minutes ago, come back just for a moment here. If I was to tell you what we're doing here, Lord's Day after Lord's Day, is presenting you with a vision of the good life, the true vision of the good life, in order to interrupt for a moment all those other competing stories and to remind you again of who you truly are and what is true and good and beautiful. If you're paying attention at all, you would say, well, it's not that exciting. You know, church is great and all, and we like you. You're a nice guy. But it doesn't have at least seemingly the same competing power, or the same, you know, drive, supercharged power that the culture presents. And that's true in a certain sense. But all change of desire comes, one, through a competing power that's more lovely, and two, it comes through a process. I remember the first time I had coffee with about 7 packets of sugar in it. It was the only way I could get it down. And it was disgusting. And I tell you right now, I love coffee. I love it. I mean, I love it probably in ways, I'm not sure if they're healthy or unhealthy, but it is a wonderful, wonderful gift. How does someone get from, I will never drink this again, this is disgusting, to, this is wonderful? Well, through acquiring it. Acquiring it through habitual use and changing, right, through that habitual use, what you find desirous, what you find tasteful. And for the sake of time, all I can say this morning is, that's the goal of this service, is to shock your system for a moment and to say, what you have found lovely, what you've been chasing, what you think is the end-all be-all of this life, and sometimes not even consciously, be awakened from those things and see the true good life. But not just see. It can't just be a thought exchange, but taste and see that the Lord is good. Know the community of God's love. Feel as you taste the bread and drink the wine, God's kindness to you. There has to be an alternate education of our desires. And that is why our service, if you will, is strange on purpose. You know, if you come here and you think, like, this is just weird, we get it. I mean, you know, I don't wear this out in public. This isn't my normal getup. Star Wars is coming back, so Jedi robe might be cool. But it's intentionally strange. If we were to model this, as is often done, after the mall, you know, that wonderful King of the Hill episode when, you know, Peg says to Hank, I want to go to the new mega church. And he's like, that church has 5,000 members. And her response is, yeah, and caters to every one of them. You know, they've got their own coffee shop and a laundromat. And he finally says, well, Peg, if I want to do that, I'd just go to the mall and think about Jesus. Even they're able to see. If you try to reshape desires by saying, well, what do you already find desirous? We'll just make a service based on that and then throw Jesus in. And all of a sudden, that will overcome your desires for all those other things. Impossible. It will only reaffirm those things that you love, because it's not first and foremost just changing out the words. It's somehow changing what you find lovely. And that takes more than a mere intellectual exchange. We have been shaped, but what if we decide to let the church shape us instead of us shaping the church? I mean, ultimately, this is why we're a liturgical church. We want the whole of what we're doing, setting before us a reenactment of the gospel, letting that story and that world with its truth and goodness and beauty begin to shape us week after week after week. And the complaint will be that it's repetitive and it's not spontaneous. And that is true. But it's because that's the only way new habits get formed. That's the only way new loves are made. I know many of you came here for the first time and said, I will never come back to that church. I've had those conversations with you. And now when you go back at times to where you formerly worshiped, you say, I have no taste for that anymore. Well, how did that happen? Through continual use and letting God show you how lovely this can be. We will see these things shown forth in the shape and rhythm and the routine of liturgy week after week after week. While one sermon may be remembered for a little while, that will not change it. No one on their deathbed goes, it was that one sermon. But in a life of 70 some odd years, 4,000 sermons, 4,000 confession of sins, 4,000 times saying the Apostle Creed, 4,000 times partaking of the Lord's Supper, that will change you. That will change what you love if you participate in faith. And that will change, Lord willing, how you begin to enact your life Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. You see, it is the gospel that changes us. And therefore, we want a service that not only preaches the gospel, but that is shaped according to the gospel. From God calling us with His own voice, us confessing our sins and Him absolving us, cleansing us from all of our guilt. His speaking His word to us. And then assuring us that we are His after we confess our faith by feeding us unto eternal life and sending us out with His blessing. I mean, this is the gospel, but it's not just the gospel heard. It's a gospel spoken and kneeled and eaten week after week after week that, Lord willing, will change us more and more into the image of the one that we love. Let us pray.